Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge. Alan's returned to us. We had a great conversation with Roger Andes last week, and we were talking a little bit about, well, you know, the title of the episode was To Be Human is to Be Impacted. And what we were doing was kind of like pressing back on a misconception about emotional sobriety that we weren't supposed to be overly, that we're not supposed to be overly impacted, that somehow emotional sobriety means a kind of walling off.
The distinction between indifference and apathy. It's like when indifference is like the weather is indifferent to us. It's like it doesn't, you know, it's like if I'm indifferent to something, and that word kind of maybe is not the right best word because it kind of brings up other connotations. But the idea is it's like I'm not really invested in that because I don't have any control over it. But the idea just because I don't have any control over it doesn't mean the weather doesn't have an impact on me.
We were going to work our way over to this new episode title for today, Proficiency Instead of Perfection. This brings to mind a recent conversation I had with Alan where I was talking about overwhelm, and I was talking about, really loading up with, ambitious tasks in life and trying to do a bunch of different things at once and feeling like I'm doing poorly in all of them. And I was asking Alan because he's a busy guy and, you know, he's similarly got a full calendar and, you know, he's got a lot of irons in the fire. He tries to do a lot. And so I was just asking him how he feels, how he brings himself to all those different things, you know, what with all the challenges and, the busyness that he has in his life. And, you know, his answer was something to the effect of, well, you know, over time, there's a kind of competence that like I've accrued so that like when you were saying, Alan, when you show up to do, you know, your responsibilities, you know, you're not going to get it perfect, but there is a proficiency that you feel that you could bring to bear that, that you can be reasonably confident about and that that's just a product of kind of doing it over time and just having kind of an easy relationship with, you know, your own capacity. And so that's maybe something we could speak to today. I have a hard time getting to proficiency.
Alan has already helped me and he hasn't spoken a word. It's like from you telling about the conversation, this idea of this, of first of all, before we went on, Alan was reading from the thesaurus of synonyms for proficiency, and that had an impact on me. And then what you just said that he was talking about is after a time, you have this general competence about stuff. And what I've been working on is talking about people, because we need to develop and we have developed to whatever degree a general confidence, which is and you kind of completed it for me, Alan. It's like, which is our general confidence and our general competence, because when I have a big thing that I've made a big deal of through the years, and that is that when we are good at something, when we are competent at something, then it's not only our right to feel confident, we have a responsibility to own our confidence in that. And that's not like saying, oh, aren't I beating my chest and that kind of stuff. But we've all worked, I've been this person, but I also worked with a person who basically, no matter how good she was, no matter how much good feedback she got, she always within minutes drifted back into low self-esteem and no confidence. And it was so irritating over time, because she wasn't owning her competence that was very apparent. And that's what you're talking about.
Another way of looking at emotional sobriety is to look at our relationship to our experiences. Or coming into recovery, I did not learn from my experience. You hear it common in the program. They say, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing. They typically say expecting different results. I think we're more insane than that. I think we expected better results.
Better. We expect improvement. Yeah.
God, I was so insane. I was off the charts.
I would go drink and I think it would be different this time. you know, and I'd find myself in a blackout again. And maybe this time even worse. This time I fought Bill Cover. Like, what the heck was I doing fighting Bill Cover? Bill Cover was 6'2". I was about 5'4". That wasn't a fair fight. I should have given Bill the first punch, right? No, I'm teasing. I know, but it was insane things like that. I didn't learn from my experience. In emotional sobriety, because we're bringing this awareness to our experiences and learning from our experience, that we grow ourselves. See, that's where our growth got arrested. I cannot grow if I don't learn from my experience. It's an impossibility. I'm going to stay stuck at a very early stage of development. That's why we say that most of us, our growth was arrested early on in our life. You know, not because we're not capable of growing, but because we weren't willing to learn from our experience or capable of learning from it. And so now we free that up. We free that whole thing up and we start learning from our experience. We start connecting dots. We start paying attention to patterns, habitual ways of reacting and thinking. We start to challenge some of our beliefs. We realize that, my God, my life was run on so many myths that I thought were true, but they weren't. They were myths. You know,
what you're describing is self-responsibility.
That's right. That's what, you know, and that's what we start to get. We start to take responsibility for the life that we are creating. Right. And this is what I've always loved about your work, Tom. It's really about challenging, you know, this passivity where we become a victim of our life rather than become the architect or, you know, the creator of our existence. And, you know, and all good psychotherapy, in my opinion, just like the program, the 12 steps are about radical self-responsibility.
My very first sponsor, and he just a few of his lines are precious, and I keep them with me all the time. It's like one of them is when he told me, AA has 12 steps of recovery, and this is exactly how he said it. The first one mentions alcohol. He said the rest of them are all about how to be a better person, be more responsible.
The whole program after step, you know, there's a second first step, which we've been talking about.
Yeah.
All of the other steps are about achieving emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
That's what they're about now. Now we can say it in that light, given that Bill said in step 12, in the 12 and 12, that if we practice these principles in our daily lives, that we and those about us find emotional sobriety.
Well, and that goes to the proficiency of the first step. You know, when we're talking about proficiency, I think about the cover of your book, the recent book, is that with the box of tools. And I remember it didn't have that at first. And I remember when you decided that was a better image for it. And I like that because the idea is when the first step I do not minimize the necessity of those of us who are drug addicts and alcoholics that we get clean and sober from that. But the first step is so much more than that. The first step is a statement of what I do not, I'm powerless. What does that mean? The things I do not control. And it's about energy efficiency. Once I identify what I cannot control, unlike what we were doing when we were drinking, it's like wasting all kinds of energy trying to change everything that we couldn't control, didn't have a chance in hell of controlling. And now we become the first step puts us in a place, what can I do something about? And now I can get busy and do it. And that becomes what the first step delivers.
I found it very helpful for you to bring up the before times, the insane times, because there's a dynamic now in my recovery some years in where what progress I'm making, it's a little bit like the pot that won't boil or like the plant that's just gradually growing under the light. And I have no way of like marking my progress. I hope that I'm making progress. I hope that I'm gaining proficiency. And the only way or the main way that I've discovered to build that proficiency at this point is just to put it to work. you know, to stress test it. And I'm just trying to add things, add goals, involve myself with, with education and useful action. And it's mixed results. Like I, like I said, I've been, with work, with relationships, with fellowship things, I've been doing more and more. And I feel like I'm pulling, 6 out of 10s, 5 out of 10s, 4 out of 10s sometimes for
the assessment of that. You guys tell me if you disagree, but I mean, maybe there's a few exceptions to this, but it's like for the most part, the one of the things we need to learn, and I think most of us don't, we want to know how we're doing right now. It's hindsight. That's how we measure our progress. I mean, it may be over the, when we tell stories, there's a reason we go back and tell about what idiots we were, is because the contrast helps us understand the progress. But there's also small ways like that. I mean, you can realize what you did right yesterday easier than you can know that you're doing it right then. And because that kind of paralyzes us if we think we're having to figure out if this is exact, because that's the perfectionism. Am I doing the exact right thing, or am I using my intuition and instincts to take a different direction? And I'll review this, soon.
Well, right, because paralysis comes very easy to me. Like I feel like one of the main things.
It's a talent. It's a talent you have, right?
Right. No, but it's ever present. It's like that's my resting speed is zero. Is, just like, and so if I'm not pushing against it, it makes my life very frenetic. I don't mean to get too into the weeds about my own experience, but like, mm-hmm. I feel like, anyway.
No, listen, I love that. It's a talent. It is. Look at some of our character defects. We hone to perfection. There's no question about it. I mean, because we really believe that that's, what we needed to be okay. That was our adaptation as we talk about it. But,
it was our best effort. That's the thing. We were doing our best our best is hopefully always getting better, but it's like if I tell a story well into my recovery, but from 15 years ago, it's like I would like to think that basically my expectations of myself today can be higher than that, because I can function better than I did 15 years ago. It's like so we do want to just make room for ourselves to just continue to grow.
That's it. And see, that's what we started with, and it is an interesting thing, because Harry Thiebaud said an interesting thing that really was behind this idea, because we talked about proficiency, not perfection, right? Progress, not perfection. It's the same idea that we're striving for that. But because, as Thiebaud said, the ego or the false self has an uncanny way of trying to regenerate itself, that we start to apply this perfectionism into our program. And we start to now demand, and this is how we can tell if we're going down that path again, is that now things become compulsive. We must do it this way or it's not okay. And that becomes problematic. Yeah. That becomes problematic as soon as it becomes compulsive, meaning we lose the choice. And see, that's what happens here. If we could boil emotional sobriety down to one thing, and I've heard you say this, Tom, and I've echoed this too in my teachings, is that emotional sobriety is about regaining our choices in life.
Yeah.
At some point, we lost those. And emotional sobriety is about regaining and recovering our ability to make these choices, about being able to live in that pause long enough to see what our possibilities are, our alternatives are, and choosing amongst those the best possibility.
I'm noticing a real commonality between you two, that you're a live free or die type, both of you guys. I mean, you don't seem to be fit into anybody else's framework very comfortably. Is that fair to say?
Well, I've been trying to make Tom into my image for a long time, and I've just given up on it. It's an impossibility. Trying to stick that guy in a box is like...
I think of my higher power in the image of Alan. It's like, yeah, it's... Or like a friend of mine used to say, when he was another therapist, he would say to people, he said, let me help, turn it over to a lower power. It's like, you know, I'm curious, what does live free and die mean, or die mean?
I think it's that old revolutionary flag, freedom.
Well,
or
yeah,
die.
But I'm when you said it, I don't think that applies to me, but I'm curious.
Well, you don't seem to be working anybody else's program. You made your own program and something that makes sense to you. And, you know, you are ensconced by, you know, a world of your own making.
Now, I tell you, the smartass is always the first one that speaks on my committee. He said, you're not working anybody's program. I'm going like I've already tried and everybody's rejected me. You know, nobody's cooperating with me. So I'm just working on myself now. It's like, but I like that you can see that, because that, again, that's what I was saying before. That's energy efficiency. I mean, we waste so much energy trying to I mean, it's just that, you know, I know I'm maybe probably overemphasize the serenity prayer stuff, but it's like, you know, this is a brick wall. I'm beating my head on it. I'm sitting there. You know, even into my recovery, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I haven't run with my head down at a 37 degree angle at this wall yet. I'm going to try that, you know, and, you know, blood's dripping down my face. It's like, you know, hopefully what we learn is, no, when you actually get to the place where I do not control other people, places, and things, that doesn't mean I'm a little low on control. It means I don't control them. You know, and I'm wasting my energy to try to change other people. We influence other people, but we do it by changing ourselves.
Well, but you know, I see that in Tom, and I hope that I've achieved some of that myself. Tom is Tom. He's okay with being Tom. You know, Tom shows up as Tom. You know, he's there's a certain characteristic to him, a certain charisma, a certain way that Tom shows up, and we know that that's Tom. He's not trying to be something that other people expect him to be. He's living up to his own standards, his own ideals in terms of who he wants to be and how he wants to show up. And that's one of the things I've always loved about you, Tom, is you're your own person. And that's great.
Because I don't think it's necessarily easy to see what I'm doing when I'm doing it. It's
like, I want to say something about this, Patrick, because you're right. See, in emotional sobriety, instead of getting concerned about living up to everybody else's expectations, we're concerned about being our own person. And that's when you've heard me say things like, you know, recovery is about recovering our lost true self. We could just say recovery is about recovering our lost self. See, because in many ways, it's so easy to get lost in this world with all the demands, expectations, ideals, shoulds, musts, all those things that are just circling around us all the time. And yeah, it's so easy to follow the wrong person home. I mean, it really is. If you think about it that way. You know, one of the first things, I'll tell you a story that in terms of meeting Dr. Kempler, because he embodied the Gestalt prayer. The Gestalt prayer goes simply, I do my thing, you do your thing. I am I and you are you. I'm not in this world to live up to your expectations. You're not in this world to live up to mine. If by chance we meet, let's enjoy it and celebrate it. If not, it just can't be helped. It's that clean. See, that's a clean way of being in the world. And that's what Fritz's idea was in terms of how we have to function, right? Is that I can't impose my expectations, demands on you. I can make requests all day long. I could say, hey, would you be willing to do this? Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah.
But when I turn them into a demand is when really trouble starts. But the story I was going to tell you, so Kempler saw something in me that I didn't see in myself early on. And he wanted to really bring me in and cultivate, you know, essentially make me an apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
Model of teaching, right? Back in the old right. West, if you were going to be a medical doctor, you mm-hmm. came in and you worked with the medical doctor. If you're going to be a lawyer, you sat in and you worked mm-hmm. with the lawyer. That kind of thing is that we learn through, you know, through watching and doing with the person mm-hmm. that had the skills. So he invited me to go over to Europe with him and to participate, to observe his training program in Holland. Mm-hmm. And he had a little farm that was built in the 1600s, the farmhouse, and he had about 4 acres of land. And he cleared an acre of that land. The rest of it was corn, but he cleared an acre of it for the students from the University of Amsterdam to come and set up their tents and then come into his house, which he had this huge living room. And everybody would come in there for the training sessions. And then they'd go back out and they'd sleep in their tents, eat their lunch, and then come back in the house. And we'd interview families and stuff. Nice. Like,
yeah.
And it was really cool, man. I mean, I was there for a month when I went over. And I was there the first few days and he was married to a Dutch woman and Elsa. And Ilse was very hazelic, is the Dutch word. It's very welcoming and hosting and wanted to take care of me. And she was making all these plans about taking me around and showing me to Grava, which is the town outside of where they lived and stuff. And Walt walked in the room and said, "What are you doing?" She goes, "I'm coming up with all these ideas about where we're going to take Alan." He goes, you didn't talk to me about any of that. And I go, awkward.
Yeah, yeah, you're going. Yeah.
You know, it's like I want to disappear at this point in time. Conflict is coming. But what his point was that you don't get to decide what I'm doing without consulting me to see if I'm interested. And I had never seen anybody assert themselves in that way and risk creating tension to be considered. He wasn't going to let her erase him, and he wasn't going to just be a good host when he wasn't being consulted to be a part of it. And I'm telling you, that blew my mind. I had never seen another human being operate where he wasn't standing against her. He wasn't saying, "You're wrong for wanting to do this with Alan." He was saying, "You're wrong for including me in plans that you didn't discuss with me." Mm-hmm. It was, wow. It was like, God, this guy was himself. Mm-hmm. And I'd never seen anybody own themselves in that mm-hmm. themselves in that way that he owned yeah. himself. And it was a big lesson, man. And I'm telling you, I saw that play out from, you know, I was with Walt for almost 20 years. And I saw him hold on to himself so well under some situations that were very challenging. And he, most of the time, he wasn't perfect by any means, but most of the time, he was able to find that line of holding on, standing for himself without standing against you.
Yeah.
And that was an amazing skill that I saw in him. I mean, it was, he looked like a grown-up. I mean, it was, you know, from my perspective, you know, I'm like, what? I was probably in my 30s at that point in time. I'm like, wow, this is what grownups look like. I mean, this is how it was quite inspiring to me.
Stand for yourself, you win. If you stand against someone else, you lose. And it's like that is, so my point being that it shows up in different, in lots of our work because it's just absolutely essential to being an adult. You know, it's like, you know, not, I was reading a book from a woman this morning that had a line in it that it made me think, and I'm going to keep thinking on it. But she said, the ego loves to suffer, you know, and it's like, you know, and we'll fight when you start to, you know, go beyond the ego and go into your more of your true self, your intuition and this kind of stuff. He said the ego is going to fight for its space and it wants to suffer. And it's like that. And that's the ego wants to fight people. or at least my experience with that was that I did that. Yeah.
The bigger experience was watching his work with these Dutch families, because he didn't speak a lot of Dutch, but they had an interpreter. And I could see how universal some of these issues were, about how the issues in families, the givens and the struggles that they had, are cut across culture.
It occurred to me with the proficiency instead of perfection, that you look great, and you told me that you've been back exercising since your surgery. And like, I have my own physical recovery that I've been working through, and I just can't, it's an evolving situation. my ability to be able to get moving and to attain some level of, you know, let's just say like competence moving from A to B. And I just wanted to ask if you could say a few words about like, how's your progress been, and or like, how's your emotional sobriety been, meaning that?
Well, you know, when I look back after these last 2.5 years, my goodness, is my life, if I've been challenged with dealing with life on terms, man, I'll tell you. And it's still going on. I mean, physically, I think this last surgery was very good in my foot. I've actually started to sleep through the night. And I haven't had a full night's sleep in probably 4 months. And I was really, really struggling through the day. I'd have to take 2 or 3 little cat naps. You know, I get a lot of rest in 5 or 10 minutes if I lay down. But it's no way to live my life. I mean, I'm just, you know, staying on that edge all the time of feeling very tired and fatigued. So that's been wonderful. I've, from a physical point of view, my left leg is not fully healed yet from my hip surgery. Mm-hmm. That fracture really set me back. And I'm trying to decide how I'm going to deal with that going forward, because there was really malpractice involved in this whole thing. So, you know, part of me, I've never sued anybody for anything. I don't believe in that. There's been certain situations where I could have. But in this case, the guy really made a mistake, and he didn't try to make me whole. And I'm considering doing something about that, because it's cost me clients, because I had to be on some of the opiates longer than I wanted to, and I fell asleep in some sessions, and people were good enough. I never charged them and stuff like that. But it really wore on the relationships with a few people in terms of what was going on. And the fact I wasn't as proficient, you know,
what happened to you was extreme too.
It was extreme. And so people are used to me being at a pretty high level when I show up with them in therapy. And I wasn't at my usual level, and people felt that, which was unfortunate. So, you know, I'm dealing with that. I'm trying to consider that. I'm healing some of the stuff that's going on. You know, my little, 6-year-old who just turned 7, Cece, she overheard me talking to somebody the other day, and this who's has some kids that went through a divorce, and she came in and she said to him, you know, I just want you to know that it's really hard on kids when parents go through a divorce. And she said, it's been really hard on me. Unbelievable, man.
Wow.
That she talk like that and share her stuff. And, you know, poor Maddie's really been going through a lot, but you know, we're in therapy and we're dealing with this stuff. And, and you know, what I've been learning is that sometimes keeping my mouth shut is the best thing I can do. I mean, instead
Lord
of
God, but that's a valuable lesson in my life. Absolutely.
Tell you, man, I've always been the one. I want to say something. I want to be heard and stuff, but sometimes that does no good, and it doesn't help and add to a situation. So, you know, I'm learning to let go. I mean, even at this point in time, and the value of letting go and letting the process happen, and I don't have to control the process. I can have more trust that it's going to take care of itself, and I see that. And so, you know, it's funny that, you know, there's always this ongoing learning that's taking place and stuff like that. So that's the thing that I think I feel best about, Patrick. I think I've really taken this suffering, and it's been a lot, man, both physically and so, you know, from a family point of view, from an emotional point of view, and really you know, been learning an awful lot from it. You know, I'm just continuing. I'm in therapy and I'm getting a lot out of my personal therapy and I'm in family therapy. So, look, the thing I feel good about is I practice what I preach. I mean, I really believe that, man. If a cook is not eating his, if a chef is not eating his food, you better not order something from him, man.
Yeah, I don't want any of that. Yeah,
I don't want any of it either, man. But if a guy is saying, man, I like what I'm cooking, it's working for me, that's the guy I want to follow. And that's who Walter was. And hopefully that I'm able to achieve some of that in my own personal life.
Absolutely.